Wilhelm!
Yeah, I'll just fill my pipe.
Kill them. Kill them both. We're missing Antiques Roadshow.
Aren't you ever dramatizing this situation?
We're interrupting this program to bring you the most exciting piece of news that's happened since the war.
Like magic, an invisible chain of sound once more circles the planet.
Anything can happen in the next hour.
Who else has electricity streaming from his eyeballs and from his fingers?
Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Talking about cause and effect in the outside world. We're not living in the outside world.
You know, it's a pity you weren't born a girl.
Yes, I've always envied you that.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema. All lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content, so if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Hi, and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 69. And as it is number 69, I thought I'd do a couple of movies that are not entirely unrelated to acts of carnality. This is Terry Frost, by the way. And weather here has been almost a kind of apocalyptic. I know that North America's had a lot of snow and sleet and blizzards and polar bears traveling to Miami and all sorts of other shit like that. But here we had two cyclones. This is after the floods that I mentioned last time around, of course. We had two cyclones, one after the other, hit North Queensland. One of those cyclones kind of did a boomerang through Central Australia. And last night we got hit by it. We had high winds, there's a bit of flooding around the place. We're okay. Our place got a temporary brook running down the side of it, but nothing worse than that. But all the local rivers are brimming their banks, and there are a few road closures and all sorts of other things happening here. We've got more storms coming through later today, so we may get to hear those on the podcast, depending on how long it takes me to do it. But in general, if you know anybody who says that global warming isn't happening, could you please smack them upside the head, put them on an aeroplane, and we will get them to work doing reconstruction in Queensland. Something's happening here. I don't know what it is. I know that extreme weather events are now becoming more frequent, and we're going to have to adapt to that. And I think that there's an opportunity for it to bring out the best in people, which it has done in Queensland and the rest of Australia, where floods are happening, and floods have happened down here as well. It's got an opportunity to bring out the best in people. It's also got the unfortunate opportunity to bring out the worst in people, and we've seen a bit of that as well. The government's here in Australia is putting a flood levy on the income tax. We've got to kind of rebuild one of our major capital cities, and so there's a flood levy which is going to cost the average rich bastard about $100 and $250 per year. The opposition leader here, Tony Abbott, who is quite a fundamentalist person of belief, decided that he was going to do a fundraiser for a Stop the Flood Levy benefit concert, or you know, for their campaign to stop the flood levy or something along those lines. So basically, this guy is raising funds to stop a levy which would rebuild one of the capital cities, rather than raising funds to rebuild one of the capital cities. So, yeah, it's politics and climate change and weather in general and extreme weather events are happening very interestingly around here at the moment. How is everyone? I'm doing fine here. I'm sorry about the little political and meteorological rant at the start of things, but it has been quite on everyone's mind around here lately. So I thought that I'd pop a little bit in there just to give it a bit of topicality. Things are going fine here. I've been watching a lot of movies. I'm still doing the radio gig. Last Friday before this one, because it's Saturday now as I'm recording, so not yesterday, but the Friday before, I had a chat with Ivor Cole up at ABC Darwin doing my Friday night gig, and we talked our way through Dr. No. And then, of course, we went into the discussion about whether Monty Norman or John Barry wrote the theme music to Dr. No, yeah, James Bond theme, dum-da-da-dum-dum, that one. And a couple of days later, he died. So maybe we've got the kiss of death on our radio thing. So it's probably better that I talk about movies on the radio that involve people who are no longer alive. And on that subject, last night was cancelled because there was a big football match in the Northern Territory, and Ivor had to do live crosses to the football, which would have interrupted what we were doing. But next time we're doing Limelight, the third last film of Charlie Chaplin. Now, I haven't been a really big devotee of Chaplin stuff previously, and it was Ivor's idea to do this movie, but I really got deeply into researching it and researching the guy's life and doing that, all that kind of thing. It's amazing the lengths I'll go to for 20-25 minutes of radio time, but regardless of that, I think I might put Limelight on the list to do for the podcast as well. I know there are some Chaplin fans out there. I've had a little bit of communication with people, so that's going on there, and I love the fact that by doing this radio thing, I'm kind of stretching myself out of my comfort zone as far as the movies I'm watching. So that's going very well. As I said, we're going up to Darwin in March, and Ivor and I are going to catch up and actually meet face to face for the first time. So I'm looking forward to that as well. And then, of course, on to Broken Hill and the Mad Max Museum. What else have I been watching? I did hook up to Mizo, which I thought was a kind of Japanese soup, but apparently it's a website which lets you track what you're watching. So I'm just going to go onto my Mizo page, and I'll tell you what I've been watching lately, because this way I don't have to worry about it. Now, living aside the movies, I watched O.C. and Stiggs, one of Robert Altman's kind of lesser-known films. Not really great stuff at all, but I like it because I like the original story of O.C. and Stiggs in National Lampoon back in the late 70s, it would have been. So I did enjoy a bit of that. It's got people like Paul Dooley in it, Ray Walston's in it, Dennis Hopper's in it. So it's not entirely an uninteresting film. Let's see what else I've been watching. The Titfield Thunderbolt, English film from the 1950s, kind of one of those small English village comedies about a small town that's trying to save their local rail line by basically privatising it and running their own train service. And that's got pretty much everybody in it. It's got Stanley Holloway in it, John Gregson, Sid James turns up in it running a steam traction engine. And if you haven't seen that one, I definitely recommend it. It's a nice little gentle English comedy of the type. Did see a documentary about Joan Rivers called Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. Now, Joan Rivers, I think it's funny. I liked her celebrity roast, which apparently she didn't like. But it's an interesting documentary on someone who's constantly reinventing themselves, one of the pioneers of female comedians. And it's a solid documentary, and whether you like her or whether you don't like her, it's an interesting place to look at. Just that kind of what it takes to become a celebrity and what it takes to maintain that celebrity as well. So I found it very interesting from that point of view. And the other thing I watched that I really, guilty pleasure kind of time, Hudson Hawk. I rewatched that. I did like Hudson Hawk at the time it came out. Not a perfect film, but I kind of like it. I like the in-jokes. I like the kind of rapport that Bruce Willis and Danny Aiello have, and kind of works in that level for me. Not the most logical of films, not the most wonderful of films, but basically guys doing in their own way, kind of like what Sinatra did with the original Ocean's 11 in about 1960 it was. Just making a movie with your buddies, nothing serious, just a few laughs, that kind of thing. One of the other things, we're only going to talk about one other. One of the other things I watched was, I don't know how many people know about this, New Faces. New Faces in 1952 was a big Broadway review kind of thing. It had Eartha Kitt in it. It was one of Eartha Kitt's first roles that brought it to the public's attention in a big way. Robert Clary, the guy who played LeBeau in Hogan's Heroes, little French song and dance guy's in there. Ronnie Graham's in there. Alice Ghostly, and some of the bits and pieces were written by some guy called Melvin Brooks. So I've been wanting to see this for a hell of a long time. It did appear very briefly in the 1980s at a kind of Encore cinema in Sydney, but I missed the showing of it. But at the moment it is out on DVD widescreen. It was originally filmed in CinemaScope, and for years you could only get a pan and scan version on American VHS, and a pan and scan DVD came out about a year ago, but this one's widescreen. The colour values aren't fantastic. Of course, it's fairly old stock, and but I enjoyed it a lot. It's interesting to kind of see a filmed stage review from the 1950s. So if you get a chance to get that, I don't know whether it's going to end up on Netflix in the States and things like that, but worth having a look at. And Eartha Kitt's always marvellous in anything she does, so... And that's about all I'm going to talk about on what I've been watching. What I'm going to do now is take a break, and then we'll get stuck into the first of the two films, being Alvin Purple from 1973, an Australian sex comedy which did big business. I didn't mention the other film I'm going to do is one of my favourites and a cult favourite of a lot of people's, Barbarella from 1968. So I'm going to now leave you with a theme song from a porno film, because it is episode 69, and that is the theme song, and porno films don't have theme songs anymore. This is a theme song from a 1980 porno film starring John Leslie and a few other people. Leslie Bovey, I think, is in it, called Champagne for Breakfast.
Champagne, so bubbly, champagne, so lovely, sparkling like pearls in the sea. One sip and you can feel your heart soaring, a trip you'll never find one bit boring, just like the bluest sky, by far the ultra high. You are so much in demand, and the champagne, you color the days with sunshine. Champagne, the pleasure is mine.
There, that should get you into the mood. So Alvin Purple, to talk about Alvin Purple and to get the full picture of how it hit Australia in 1973, you need to kind of look at the history of Australian cinema and censorship and things like that for the decade or two before that. So I'll do a brief thing on that. Basically, Australia had incredible censorship in the 1950s, 40s, 50s and 60s. Right up until 1972, when the Conservatives got out of government for the first time in two decades, almost, if not more. I haven't looked it up. Anyway, Gough Whitlam's Labor government came in. There was a new rating system for movies, the R rating system, and so movies with adult content, they could keep anybody, well, technically they could keep anybody under the age of 18 away from it. So censorship loosened up. The Board of Film and Classification, everything, all the restrictions were loosened. Hardcore pornography was still something they didn't have. But a good, honest, sexy comedy was something that really was able to be seen by the Australian public legally for the first time. And censorship kind of loosened to an enormous extent, and of course this reflected there's a comment in the documentary attached to the Alvin Purple DVD where somebody says the 1960s didn't happen in Australia until the 1970s, and this to a certain extent is true, and Alvin Purple was a part of that. The company that made it, Roadshow Entertainment, had an enormous success before Alvin was made with an imported Swedish sex comedy called Bedroom Mazurka, which I actually saw. And I'm going to try to get a copy off fairly soon. I found out that I can get it on DVD, so I'm going to do that just for pure nostalgia's sake. But it did fantastic business in Australia. People were in the mood for something light and frothy and sexy with lots of tits and arse and a good, honest, approach to sexuality, knowing, of course, the direction that people wanted to. And this isn't highbrow people that were making this bedroom mazurka famous. It was your average suburban people. And so Alan Hopgood, who had written a lot for TV, and a film director called Tim Burstall, who had made the first full-length Australian film since They're a Weird Mob, was released in 1966. He made a film called 200 Weeks in 1970. So, you know, for 4 years, there was nothing made. And Tim Burstall decided that what he wanted to do was do a sex comedy. And Alan Hopgood, and he tossed around this idea of making a comedy, and Alvin Purple is what resulted from it. This film definitely hit my radar at the time, and there was a TV documentary, a half-an-hour TV documentary about the making of the film, which was shown. There was a little bit of nudity in that documentary, but not, as of course, as much as in the film itself. It was mostly a promotional thing, and it was a way of encouraging filmmaking in Australia. The filmmakers talked about it. The documentary, as I said, is on the DVD version of Alvin Purple, but the interesting thing about it is the interview is done with the makers of the film at the top are all so serious, like, yeah, this is what I wanted to do. This is the psychology of the characters, all that sort of thing. And in retrospect, they were very earnest. But in the end, they made a very large amount of money from the film. So I'll just give you a little bit of a précis about the film and then talk a little bit about why I like it. It's a kind of sex comedy thing which follows the event. I'm reading this kind of paraphrasing from Wikipedia, by the way. The film's a sex comedy which follows the misadventures of a naive young Melbourne man, Alvin Purple, played by Graham Blundell, who women find irresistible. He tries unsuccessfully to resist legions of women who want him. Alvin is so worn out that he seeks psychiatric help to solve his problems. His psychiatrist is a woman. In the end, Alvin falls in love with one girl who doesn't throw herself at him. But I won't go and do the spoilers on. But that's basically the story. Alvin, ever since he was a school kid, women have found him irresistible. The schoolgirls are chasing him home from school on bicycles. He has an affair with one of his teacher's wives. And generally, the whole premise of the film is that the result of Alvin being irresistible to women. Now, there's a little bit at the start of the film set on a tram, which is totally at odds with the rest of the film. Really... funny bit with a bit of nudity on a Melbourne tram, but the character in that little bit doesn't seem consistent with the rest of the film for some reason. It doesn't seem consistent with what Alvin Purple, what his life is like. So that's a little bit of an odd bit, but it's always nice to see a bit of nudity. And there is a fair bit of nudity on there. There's a bit of cock nudity. There's a lot of frontal female nudity, which I find never goes astray when it's in an Australian film or a film of any other kind for that matter. The cast is pretty good. Graham Blundell, as I said, he's an actor who started in the La Mama Theatre in Melbourne and made Alvin Purple and a few other films, and later on in life and reinvented himself as a very good biographer. He did a biography of Brett Whiteley, the Australian artist. He's done a biography of Graham Kennedy, one of Australian television's first stars, which is really interesting as well. So he's kind of reinvented himself from that point of view as well. He was never a kind of blokey bloke. He was one of the lights of the Melbourne theatre scene, in a way. Now, the women in the film were interesting too, but we've also got Graham Blundell playing Alvin. Let's have a look here. Penny Hackforth-Jones plays his Dr. Liz Sort, and she refused to do nudity in the film, which is an odd thing for somebody playing a major role in a sex comedy, but what can you do? Ellie McClure, who is now teaching acting in various universities, is in it. An interesting actress called Elke Needhart is in the film. She's appeared in a couple of other films, Australian films of the time as well. She's another person who's reinvented herself. She's now a very famous opera director. She did in 2004 in Adelaide a full production of Wagner's Ring Cycle, all 12 hours. She was the director of that. And she's directed any number of operas, some here, some in Germany, some in other parts of Europe. But she's now an opera director. But at the time, she was an Australian actress. And she gets her kit off and looks very, very fine doing that. Alan Finney's in it, playing a friend of Alvin's called Spike Dooley. Alan Finney then went on to be a major force in, I think it was Roadshow. He was basically the head of Roadshow Films for a long time, and encouraged the Australian film industry to an enormous extent as well. I'm just going to play the trailer from the film now and give you a little bit of an idea about how it was plugged in 1973, but when it came out.
Alvin, make him leave, bye-bye. Alvin, make him sing, ding-a-ling, why-why. Alvin, make him cry. Alvin, make him laugh, hello.
Meet a man of many parts. All of them in full working order.
He is what's clinically known as the two maniac. That's the male equivalent of an infomaniac. He can't keep his hands off anyone.
Alvin Purple. Handsome. Charming. Artistic. From the very start, it was obvious here was a young man with a big future in front of him.
He'll get pregnant, you know.
And won't you be jealous?
Let go!
He was a popular student. Always on good terms with the staff.
Oh,
Mrs. Hallward.
There are openings everywhere for the right man. Find out what you want to do, and then extend yourself.
He became a dedicated salesman.
In this world, there's no one who can afford to be slack.
In fact, he spent most of his time on the job.
I'm still afraid of the dark.
Big girl like you?
I'm only big on some things.
Soon he was a leader in his field. What's Alvin's secret? You'll have to see the movie to find out. Tim Burstall, who gave you the outrageously funny stalk, now takes a wickedly witty look at sex through the eyes of a reluctant superstud.
You have me worried. I mean, the success of our whole operation is in your hands. You must keep up your end of the business.
I say, that's a very nice see-through I'm getting.
Oh, I didn't think anyone would notice. I've been wearing it for days and nobody said a thing.
And that's a very nice pair of breasts you're wearing, too.
Oh, do you like them?
Get over with! Right me!
Any more of them?
There's more, much more. If you liked Bedroom Mazurka and What's Up, Doc, then you'll love Alvin Purple.
Nothing says 1970s better than a voiceover by Kevin Goldsby. That's basically the movie that I was advertised, that was advertised to me when I was a kid. Now, in 1974, I wasn't 18. But in a lot of cinemas, they didn't really give a shit and they didn't ask for ID to find out whether somebody was over the age of 18 or not. So I got to see it at a terrific old Art Deco cinema in Parramatta in New South Wales called the Roxy. It's now been turned into a convention centre of some kind, but it still exists and all the kind of Art Deco-y 1930s grandeur of it's been retained to a large extent, which is nice to hear. Too many of the really grand and wonderful cinemas that I saw movies at when I was a little kid are no longer there, which is totally sad. The multi-screens have taken over, as we all know, and I think we've definitely lost a weird part of our cultural history by doing that. But anyway, the movie, as I said, it's a farce. I mean, Alvin tries for a while to be a waterbed salesman, and that gets him into even more trouble, particularly when one of the girls asks him to wear spurs to bed. And he then meets a psychiatrist called McBurney, who decides to use him as a sex surrogate. and a therapist for women who are messed up sexually. And that, of course, leads to a large scandal because, and it's not really a spoiler because it's in the trailer, McBurney secretly makes porn movies of Alvin servicing his female clientele. And when it all blows up, it goes into a court case, and after the court case and Alvin is innocent, he ends up being chased by all the husbands of the women he serviced, and there's a big car chase which involves cars ripping around a drive-in movie during the daytime, so like the drive-in place itself, skydiving, and basically Alvin being stripped naked in the middle of Melbourne. But, you know, it's a silly 1970s sex comedy, but I do like it, and I think that it's kind of important as a cultural artifact because it's, I mean, there have been people who've argued that it's sexist and things like that, but one of the things we know about any kind of liberation, whether it be sexual liberation as happened in the 1960s and 1970s, or political liberation for countries, countries like Egypt are currently going through, is that when that liberation first happens, unfortunately, there's a tendency to be excessive. So you tend to veer off into the other direction to an extreme, and there are mistakes made. And there are silly bits of business in this which now wouldn't be considered politically correct. But in the context of the fact that there was a sudden liberation, this sudden openness, this sudden ability to explore sexuality in a comedic terms at least, then, yep, you've got to forgive them their kind of youthful and enthusiastic exuberance. And looking at it now, I can go, yes, that bit would be considered sexist, but that bit would be considered sexist. But at the time, it wasn't. This wasn't made for an educated, university-educated audience. In 1973, the universities were made free. Basically, people didn't have to pay to go to university in 1973. I wish I had taken it up myself, but for various reasons, I didn't. But anyway, the literate class in Australia, the people who went to university on these free university schemes in the 70s and very early 80s, weren't around then as a kind of literate and educated intelligentsia. And so that kind of post-feminist thing about sexism and kind of revisiting the mistakes of the past, or not even the mistakes of the past, but the artifacts of the past and reviewing them from your own viewpoint, from your own modern viewpoint, didn't really occur at that stage. So basically the movie was made for the average punter and it was incredibly successful. The movie cost about $700,000 at the time to make, which was a fairly big budget for an Australian film at the time because there weren't that many Australian films at the time. And it ended up raking in close to $5 million. In 1973 dollars. That's just at the box office. That's not, you know, later on video and DVD sales and basically being able to show it on TV later on and all those sort of other things. That's just purely box office sales. The modern equivalent of that would be around $24-25 million in a domestic box office, where the population of the country is only 21 million people. So that would be an enormous box office in modern terms, and indeed it was at that stage. So successful was Alvin Purple that it spawned two movie sequels and a TV series. First off, there was Alvin Purple Rides Again, which kind of played down the sex and played up the comedy and wasn't that successful. It was a bit lame ass, really. It's on the double disc with Alvin Purple on the DVD that I've got, which was put out by Village Roadshow a few years ago. May still be available if you look around eBay and places like that if you are interested in finding it. It may be available through other means. But I recommend Alvin Purple. I don't necessarily recommend Alvin Purple Rides Again, which was made in about 1974 or 75. And just after that, the Australian Broadcasting Commission, the government broadcaster in Australia, had a short-lived TV series of Alvin Purple, which had a bit of nudity in it as well, and they turned it into a sitcom for, I think, about a dozen episodes with Alvin and his mate Spike, in this case played by Chris Haywood, and a number of attractive women rolling through his life. Of course, Alvin's very successful sexually and Spike's very unsuccessful sexually, so it was a bit of a comedy with that. It was re-shown a number of years ago on the Comedy Channel, the Alvin Purple TV series, and had a great nostalgia value. And it held up as a comedy as well at the time, so that one was actually better than the movie sequel. And then in 1984, somebody had a blinding flash of stupidity and did a second sequel to the film, a movie known as Melvin, Son of Alvin, which I don't recommend at all. The 1980s were a silly time. An actor called Jerry Sont played Melvin, who didn't know who was Alvin Purple's son, and of course inherited the charisma, and Graham Blundell's in it as Alvin as well. But really, it's an incredibly forgettable exploitation picture from 1984. Didn't have an enormous budget, and the first, of course, is always the best, with the possible exception of the Alien films. Going back to Alvin, I hadn't watched it in a number of years, like about 5 years, and I re-watched it yesterday, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it at the level it was. I enjoyed seeing the city I live in as it was almost 40 years ago, and just seeing the changes along the riverbank and along the main streets of Melbourne, and trying to pick out where certain bits of it were filmed, and all that sort of thing. So it's got that kind of historic nostalgia value. And because I didn't live in Melbourne at the time, I was a Sydney boy up until 1990. So I had no memories of Melbourne as it was at the time of Alvin Purple, or even long after that. So interesting to see it like that, because I've been here for 21 years now. And my memories only stretch of the city I live in only stretch back that far. My memories of Sydney stretch back very dimly to 1960. But Melbourne, I've got a different relationship with. It's a good, honest thing. The acting in it is quite good. Noel Ferry has a great comic turn as the judge judging the case, and who thanks everybody very earnestly for the entertainment value of this particular court case, which is, Australia's got a comedy heritage to a large extent based on the English, or at least up at that time it did. And there's something in Alvin of the Ealing comedies, leaving aside the sexuality and the tits and arse and cocks and the attractive women getting naked and all those other wonderful bits and pieces. The basic plot arc and the innocence, in a weird way, of the movie does have moments which are kind of reflective of that heritage of the British comedies of earlier times. It's kind of got an arc that kind of goes from Ealing comedies to Carry On films to Alvin Purple, through an arc there of increasing interest in slap and tickle. I've got fond memories of seeing it for the first time. I think I sat through the whole movie with a hard on, but I was young at the time. And seeing it now, I can appreciate the attractiveness. Now, there is another reason, apart from the fact that it's episode 69, why I'm talking about Alvin Purple in this podcast. One of the actresses who gets her kid off in the film is nominated for an Academy Award this year. I shit you not. Jackie Weaver, who played the matriarch in Animal Kingdom, is in Alvin Purple, young, attractive, and naked. So I thought that's as good an excuse as any to bring up this film. She's had a long career in Australian stage and screen, and is a highly respected actress. She's just kind of iconic in the Australian media scene. She was married to a talk radio guy for a long time, Darren Hinch, but they've now separated, and she's really a kind of national treasure. She's got a little bit of the kind of Judy Dench about her in the Australian cultural scene. And going back and seeing young Jackie Weaver and then comparing it to Jackie Weaver in Animal Kingdom is an interesting exercise, and all strength to her for her ongoing career. And the other thing I should mention about the film is the camera operator is quite a well-known fellow as well. Here's a list of the movies he subsequently ended up being cinematographer on. I'm going to work backwards on the list from now into the past. He was a cinematographer on The Tourist, Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, Cold Mountain, Dreamcatcher, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, Perfect Storm, The Talented Mr. Ripley, City of Angels, The English Patient, The American President, The Firm, Lorenzo's Oil, Dead Poets Society, Rain Man, Gorillas in the Mist, The Mosquito Coast. It's John Seale. He, the same guy who was the cinematographer on all of those films, was the cinematographer on Alvin Purple. And the film does look good. It was filmed on 35mm at the time. Seale was very early in his career. He'd done a bit of television before that as a camera operator. And this film, it's interesting looking back on the history of people's careers just to see where they came from and what parts they played in it. He was also the assistant cameraman on The Man from Hong Kong. He was a camera operator on Picnic at Hanging Rock. Let's have a look at what else he did some work on. He was he's the DP on The Rum Diaries, a new movie with Johnny Depp based on Hunter S. Thompson's book. He was a camera operator on Gallipoli and The Odd Angry Shot and any number of classic Australian films. You'll see John Seale there somewhere. And the film does look good from that. Apparently, from the documentaries that are attached to the DVD, they had a combination of cowboys and real professionals. So they had people come in and really help them with the movie. And some of them had more skill than others. And because the Australian film industry at that stage was in the very early stage, there was a lot of people who wanted to be involved in it, but not a lot of people who had a lot of experience. And in spite of that, they made quite an interesting little sex comedy. I'm not saying that this thing's the next Gone with the Wind or... Well, actually, I don't like Gone with the Wind, so forget that. The next Citizen Kane. But it's an interesting and it's a good, honest sex comedy. It's part of the film culture of my country and the film history of my country. And there are people in the film who are still working, some of them in vastly different areas. Elke Needhart doing opera now, Graham Blundell being a biographer and a journalist as much as he is involved in the theatre, Jackie Weaver being nominated for a Best Actress Oscar, Best Supporting Actress Oscar. It's interesting how the tentacles of careers kind of weave their way back through time. So somebody who's doing something now, if you look backwards, there's always an interesting mosaic of people working with people going back through time. And that's of course one of the interesting things about diving more than shallowly into the pool of cinema, just finding those relationships and just grooving on the intricacy of how people in one industry, which has a worldwide impact, really kind of ended up working together. Anyway, that's about it for Alvin Purple. As I said, see if you can find a copy of it. You're not going to be disappointed if you go in there with the expectations of a good romp. And it's the sort of film, sex comedies of this sort aren't really films that get made these days. There aren't any really good tits and ass nudity sex comedies being made. There might be a few indie ones just for nostalgia value, but it's not really part of the cinema landscape in the 21st century, which is a little bit sad because I've got a slight fondness for them. We've all got fondness for the films we saw when we were young. And I do like this one. So I'm going to take another break now and come back and we'll look at a bit of Barbarella.
Gainsbourg et son Gainsborough ont pris le ferryboat. De leur lit par le hublot, ils regardent la côte. Ils s'aiment et la traversée durera toute une année. Ils vaincront les maléfices jusqu'en 70.
69 années érotiques. 69
et son Gainsborough vont rejoindre Paris. Ils ont laissé derrière eux la Tamise et Chelsea. Ils s'aiment et la traversée du
durera toute une année, et que les dieux les bénissent jusqu'en 70.
69 année érotique. 69
et la traversée durera toute une année. Il pardonnera ses caprices jusqu'en 70.
69 année érotique. 69 année érotique.
That was Serge Gainsbourg and Jane Birkin singing Soixante-Neuf en Erotique. And I just thought I'd throw that in because when I remembered it was the 69th Paleo Cinema podcast, I thought, I've got to play that song when it happens. So on to Barbarella. Now, Barbarella is another one that had a big impact on my childhood. When I used to go around poster shops, amongst other places, when I was a kid, looking around at movie posters and things. I had two really cool movie posters on my walls when I was a child. The first one was The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, walking through the streets of New York. Second one was Billy and Captain America on their choppers from Easy Rider. Now, both of those were black and white posters, and movie posters, you know, like photographic movie posters were very popular in those days, and I'm not even sure how I got either of them, but I had them for years and years, and I would love to have them now, but unfortunately I don't. And the other poster I wanted but never, ever, ever got was a poster of Jane Fonda in Barbarella, wearing the kind of tight, leathery-looking costume with the transparent tit shield over one tit. So I've got a bit of a history with this one. I didn't see it till I was an adult. It wasn't, you know, for a start, they wouldn't let kids in to see Barbarella when it first came out. It was cut in Australia as well. And by the time I got to see it, it was VHS days. And to be honest with you, let's kind of settle this right now. It's a silly film. It makes no sense. It's absurd. It's style very much over substance. But having said that, it's a lot of fun. I don't even know that I need to do a praise of this film, but I'll give it a little bit of a go for those who just walked in. In an unspecified time in the future, Barbarella, Jane Fonda, is assigned by the President of Earth, played by Claude Dauphin, to find a missing Earth scientist called Duran Duran, who they are afraid the people of Tau City are going to use to make weapons. Now, the rest of the universe is peaceful and loving, and they really don't want to start somebody giving weapons to a bunch of barbarians. Barbarella sets out to find the missing scientist. She crashes on Tau City on an icy plane and gets knocked unconscious by two little girl twins who hit her on the head with a snowball covering a crystal. Barbarella is taken to the wreckage of Duran Duran's spaceship, and inside the wreckage she's tied up, and several wild-looking children emerge from within the ship. They set out several dolls which have razor-sharp teeth to bite her. And she meets the first of the adults that she meets in Tower City, Mark Hand, who's the catchman who patrols the ice looking for children. The children on Tower City are left in the wild to fend for themselves until they're of a certain age, and then they're brought into the city of Sogo, which, in case you didn't know, is a reference to Sodom and Gomorrah. So Mark Hand rescues Barbarella and introduces her to the good old-fashioned way of making love, as opposed to the way humans on Earth do, which is pretty much pop a pill, hold hands, and make your hair go curly. So I'm going to play a little bit of audio from Barbarella now. I'll actually play the trailer just to set the mood for this one, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Meet the most beautiful creature of the future. Her name is Barbarella, and she makes science fiction something else. Jane Fonda is Barbarella. Barbarella is a five-star, double-rated astronavigatrix Earth girl whose specialty is...
love.
Shall I tell you what I would like?
I think I know.
Her top secret mission is a real wing-dinger.
Many dramatic situations begin with screaming. Aswita Sonja! Aswita Sonja! Could you hand me a garment?
See Barbarella do her thing with the nice angel. With the warm, friendly Iceman. With a cold, evil Black Queen.
Hello, pretty, pretty.
With a charming hand-to-hand Romeo. See Barbarella do her thing in the wild, excessive machine.
Sort of nice, isn't it?
In the biting birdcage, in the chamber of dreams, in the labyrinth of love, in the deadly dollhouse, in the palace of pleasure. Adventure beyond your imagination when you get lost in space with Barbarella.
This one definitely has to come under the classification of groovy movie. It was made in 1968. It was directed by Roger Vadim, who was at the time married to Jane Fonda, which was after he was married to Brigitte Bardot, who was the original inspiration for Barbarella in the comic book by Jean-Claude Frost, upon which the movie was based. And, of course, Roger Vadim then went on to... I think he had an affair or he married Catherine Deneuve. I think he may have married Catherine Deneuve. I think he went on with a bunch of other people. But basically, he was one of the guys who married at least three of the great beauties of the 1960s. Not a fantastic film director in his later career. He did Pretty Maids All in a Row with Rock Hudson in the 1970s. But, you know, the guy had some chops. The film, of course, based on the Jean-Claude Forest comic book, had a shitload of writers. I'm just going to read out the list. Jean-Claude Forest, of course, Claude Brulé, Terry Southern, who wrote Candy, Roger Vadim, Vittorio Bonicelli, Clement Biddlewood, Brian Dagar, and Tudor Gates, who worked on a number of Hammer films. Starring in the film, Jane Fonda at her sexiest. I think there's only one film I find her more sexy in, and that was Sunday in New York with Rod Taylor. But that's me. It's got Jean-Philippe Law playing Pygar the Angel, and he was good looking at the time. Of course, he's famous for Danger Diabolic and a number of other things. Attack Force Z later on. The Love Machine, based on a Jacqueline Suzanne novel, which is a pretty soap opera kind of film, but might be interesting to watch with a bunch of drunken people. Anita Pallenberg, who was a girlfriend to Brian Jones and also to a couple of other of the Rolling Stones. Her voice in the film was redubbed by the English actress Joan Greenwood. And I think it works really well. Joan Greenwood, with her kind of sexy upper-class voice, really makes that work. And, of course, it has Milo O'Shea playing the character upon which the pop band Duran Duran's name was based. And it's really interesting. We've also got Marcel Marceau in a talking role in this film. David Hemmings playing a revolutionary called Dildano, who has a few comic scenes with Barbarella. Originally, the Dildano character they started filming it with another actor. They started filming it with Antonio Sabato, senior, not junior. But he didn't really have the comic touch for it, so they recast with David Hemmings, who was very popular at the time, and who has the comedic scene where he tries to do Earth style, pop the pill, hold hands, sex, and finds it an unusual experience. But the thing I love about this film, there's a couple of things. I'll narrow it down to three. One, of course, is Jane Fonda naked. The other two are the music by Bob Crewe and a bunch of other people. In fact, Dave Gilmour from Pink Floyd was one of the session musicians on this. The music, the soundtrack album is fantastic. You can just play it end to end, and it's pretty cool and groovy to just have in the background while you're doing something else. And it's got, of course, the lovely theme song. I'll just mention one other thing before I mention the third thing that I like about it. Cinematography was by Claude Renoir, and the film, actually, that rolls into the third thing. The third thing is the look of the film. The set designs, the special effects, the costumes, they're all fucking lovely. There's a whole bunch of really groovy 1960s psychedelic effects when Barbarella's ship is heading towards Tower City, and of course when the Matmos attacks the city of Sogo, and just the whole look of the film is like a fashion shot. And of course the film's inspired any number of kind of fashion spreads. Kylie Minogue did a music video where she ripped it off mercilessly. Don't have a lot of time for Kylie Minogue. And basically it's the fashions in there haven't dated. They've got that kind of 60s classic fashion and classic makeup look, so none of it looks particularly dated in 21st century, which I find interesting. Even if you have the sound turned off, the visual richness of the film is marvellous and a lot of fun to watch. It's I always kind of hoped that one day somebody would invent a t-shirt that shows video. And I've worked out one of the films I want to have on that t-shirt that shows video, maybe I could put like an SD card into the back of it or something, would be Barbarella just running widescreen across my chest. The number of other films as well. I mean, Kiss Me Deadly would be another one that I put on there. So if you want, tell me if you had a video t-shirt, which movie you'd like to have running on your video t-shirt when you go out to, just to kind of shock and amuse people. And so, yeah, anyway, that's a side issue, but the visual richness of the film is lovely. I'd love to, I don't know whether it's out on Blu-ray yet. If it comes out on Blu-ray, I'm there. Because I really want to kind of get a sharper picture on a copy of Barbarella that I can. And the DVD I've got's a few years old. It doesn't have too many extras on it. And that's a bit of a shame, because I'd like to know more about the making of the film than I do know. Got a few other bits of trivia. Of course, we all know that Dildano's password is the name of a real village in Wales, a village that I have visited, and where the people are very, very nice and they have lovely pub food. Barbarella's costume was inspired by Paco Rabanne's designs. Let's have a look there. She was the first female science fiction hero to be adapted into a feature film. So how about that? Apparently, Raquel Welch turned down the title role for Barbarella, which I don't think it would work with Raquel Welch, and I don't think she's as nuanced an actor as Jane Fonda is. And Jane Fonda has a deft touch of comedy to this very day that I think that Raquel Welch probably lacks. So that was, in a sense, a good decision for them. There are some missing bits from the film that may have been cut out as well. Apparently, the lobby cards still exist, showing a seduction scene between Barbarella and the Black Queen, which would have been interesting. And the end of the film kind of implies a couple of things too. Pygar, the angel, flies off with both Barbarella and the Queen of Sogo tucked under his arm. So there's a menage a trois that would be well worth a sequel. Sorry, I'm being a bit silly about this. But, yeah, and of course, we can't go without mentioning the title sequence of the film where Jane Fonda does an out-of-space zero-G striptease, which, of course, was filmed on a sheet of plexiglass. You can see it in a little bits where she's playing around with her gloves. But for the time, I think it was a lovely, audacious thing to do to try to mimic zero-G. And, of course, they knew zero-G from the Apollo astronauts and the various bits and pieces. So they knew zero-G existed in those days. And just having a zero-G striptease at the start of a film with a very nice-looking spacesuit costume. I really like the oil effect of the shiny oil coming down the mask and revealing the face of Jane Fonda. I think they may have filmed that one in reverse and pumped oil up into a double-layered helmet or something like that. But whichever way it goes, it shows that kind of loveliness of design that's probably one of the great virtues of this film. It really does have an inventiveness, maybe not in the script and things, but, you know, but there's a bit of inventive dialogue, there's a little bit of fun in the dialogue, but it was written by about as many writers as you get in your average 21st century sitcom, so I don't suppose I can complain about it for that point of view. But there are some funny lines in there. There is some silliness, but the richness of it visually and, of course, the music audibly are what really sells this film. As science fiction is not necessarily great, but as science fantasy, it's just got that boldness that I really do appreciate, and I've got a lot of time for. It's not a film I'd watch all the time, as often as I watch some other films, but every now and then it's not a bad one to just kind of revisit and remind yourself why you liked it the first time around. Apparently there is supposed to be a remake done. Of course, there's a remake of everything being done at the moment because they've got a drought of imagination in Hollywood at the moment. Various people have been suggested. There was a talk of a sequel years ago with Drew Barrymore in it. There's talk of a sequel with Rose McGowan and all sorts of other people in it. But it'd have to be bloody good to really match the original. I don't think that we live in an age that's generous to this kind of thing. As I said about Alvin Purple, that kind of sex comedy with nudity and a bit of fun and a kind of joyous sexuality isn't something that particularly Hollywood seems to be doing these days. There's no fun in sexuality the way there was in films of the past. Now, I may sound like an old fart, and I'm not going to apologise if I do. I think that we all know that sex is fun. I don't think that our cinema often enough reflects that. Sex is a source of tension and drama. It's not necessarily a playground the way it should be. Anyway, I'm not going to rant on that anymore. If you haven't got a copy of Barbarella, pick it up. It's dead cheap to get. It'd be interesting if somebody, you know, like Criterion did a Criterion edition of Barbarella. I know it's not as deep as some of the other films that they've done Criterion editions of, but if they could gather together the material to really do a whole bunch of interesting extras on that, it'd be a great one to have. And of course, the film, I should mention also, was produced by that great schlockmeister Dino De Laurentiis. So it's got everything happening for so basically that's Barbarella. It is a lot of fun. It's got that bouncy sexual exuberance about it. There aren't too many sex scenes. There's the before and after scenes more than anything else. But in spite of that, there's some nice incidental nudity in it and a sensualness. Sensuality about it that I kind of like. It's a feast for the eyes in a lot of different ways. Anyway, going to go and rest my throat muscles for a little while again, and then we'll get back with Dr. Zom's feedback. I only got one real piece of feedback this time, and it's from our good friend Dr. Zom, and I'll play that, and I'll let you get on with the rest of your day after that.
A beggar is sorrow, the devil is hate, a dream is tomorrow, a fool cannot wait. An artist is beauty that rises above, to look in the eyes of an angel is love. A mother is giving, a baby is need, a garden is living where doubt is a weed. A man made of truth wears the sign of the dove, who knows when he speaks to an angel. An
On to the feedback. We only got one piece of feedback this time, but it is from the inimitable Dr. Zom. And I'm about to play for you right now, where he adds yet one more voice to his immense repertoire of people he takes a piss out of.
Welcome to the penal colony of French Guiana, whose prisoners you are, and from which there is no escape. Paleo cinema from the depths of the jungles of the Belgian Congo comes a horror like you've never seen before. Wild Simbas rioting in the streets are nothing compared to what I bring you, and I bring you Zom. Paleo Cinema, this is Dr. Zom, and I'm calling to discuss a movie that is near and dear to my heart. That movie stars the king of cool, Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman, and the movie is called Papillon. The reason this movie is near and dear to my heart is that it came out when I was but a wee sprig, playing in the backyard and with an active imagination that could put me in any circumstance. My friends and I could be cowboys riding on the plains, fighting Indians. We could be astronauts sitting in a lunar module, or going to investigate a monolith on the moon. But one thing we always like to do would be to play movies that we had seen or heard about. And I vividly remember a time as a child, my friend telling me about this movie called Papillon that had come out. And as kids are so enamored with weird or gross things or whatever, he proceeded to tell me how they made Steve McQueen. He was in prison and he had to eat bugs to survive. I was really, really enthralled by the idea, you know, that, oh my God, you know, this, I've got to see this. Steve McQueen's eating bugs to survive. Well, the movie is, of course, a lot more than that. But at the time, you know, we actually began to play Papillon in the backyard. And anyway, I've seen this movie quite a few times over the years, and it is a personal favorite. It's one of those ones that I would almost like to see remade. I know it's a classic, and I know the R word is taboo to some people, but I would kind of almost like to see it redone even more gritty and, you know, kind of stay true to the book. But anyway, and maybe even actually have, you know, some French actors playing French characters. Steve McQueen was good, and so was Dustin Hoffman. And, you know, I know it was a Hollywood feature, so they wanted to get some big names in there. But, you know, for the most part, you know, not for the most part, you know, everybody basically in the movie is, you know, either a British actor or American or whatever. But there aren't, since it takes place in French Guiana, there aren't, doesn't seem like there's a lot of French-speaking people in it. And these prisoners are supposed to be from France. But anyway, I like the movie. I've actually read the book, and I thought the book was very good, too. There's a little bit of controversy on whether, you know, the guy who wrote the book, Henri I can't pronounce his last name, but Charnay, whatever. Anyway, that's me butchering the English language or the French language. But I like the movie. It's high adventure, and it's a good prison movie, you know, in that genre. But Paleo Cinema, I just wanted to call and let you know that it's warming up over here. It's not quite 104 degrees like it is over there, but we are expecting massive blizzards and snow showers and ice on the way. So if you don't hear from me ever again, you know that I submitted to the Snow Queen's anal probes, and I have passed on into the light. This is Dr. Zom calling from some place that I'll never do. If saying Zom.
Thanks for that, Zom. Always a charming thing. I know that you weren't entirely happy with this voicemail, but to be honest with you, mate, I am. I will point out a couple of things. First off, the Simbas were in Africa and French Guiana is in South America. Just a point. Not going to go any further than that with it. The other thing is, yeah, Papillon, I did see it in the cinemas way back in my misspent youth. It was, I think it might have been at one of the big cinemas in George Street in Sydney, the one opposite where the Village Cinemaplex is now. And I remember seeing it there and going, oh, shit, I hope I never go to a French prison in South America, because it really sucks, and then you've got to ask Dustin Hoffman to pull things out of his ass to help you. But anyway, yeah, I really should revisit Papillon. I'm going to have to see whether I can locate a DVD of it if it's out on DVD. But yeah, it's one of those films where I should check it out, and it's one of those films that shows Steve McQueen stepping out of his comfort zone as well. It would be good to see a remake with a French-speaking cast. I mean, you could have someone like Vincent Cassel or somebody like that in there to give it a bit of a boost. There are some really great up-and-coming, good-looking and quite cool French actors as well. The guy who plays the lead role in Largo Winch, for instance, you could put together do a French-speaking remake of it. I'd be very happy with that as well. It is essentially a French story, and if they could get the budget together, of course, French budgets, due to the language difficulties, aren't necessarily able to hit the astronomical sums that American feature film budgets are. But yeah, I can see your point. There's another thing for people to send me comments about. Which film would you like to see remade? and done well. There are some movies where some things have been adapted and really haven't done justice to the source material. I mean, I'd like to see a Modesty Blaze movie. I know that Tarantino had something to do with My Name is Modesty in 2004, which was made just basically to keep the rights on it. But I would love to see a Quentin Tarantino Modesty Blaze movie. I know he used some of the same things a little bit in Kill Bill. But, yeah, it'd be an extremely groovy thing, particularly if they made it as a 1960s period piece. I know they're doing X-Men First Class as a 1960s period piece. But I think it might be something to really look at having a go at. So that's about it. Anyway, I'm going to go away now. We've got some more rain on the way. So I want to make sure that every hatch is battened down before we get that hitting us. If you're up where it's stormy, please stay safe. If you're where it's flooding or where it's hot or where there are bushfires, actually there were bushfires a couple of days ago in Victoria, not as bad as they might have been in other circumstances, but nonetheless, and I know there were some in WA as well. So anyway, everybody stay safe from Mother Nature is pretty much the message I want to send on that. I'll be back in 2 weeks with something else. Enjoy your movie viewing. You can contact me through the usual means, colguru@gmail.com with a K, not the Gmail part. On the Facebook, as Paleo Cinema, one word, lowercase, no dash, on Twitter, or as Terry Frost, lowercase and no dash, on Twitter as well. So anyway, that's about it for this time around. Before I go, I really should do a shout out to the other podcasts around the place. They do it for me, so I'm more than happy to. Thank you very much to Brian over at the Hammockers Podcast for podicating his most recent episode, the Sundance, the Samakus episode, to me and this podcast. I feel honoured by that, Brian. Thank you very much, mate. Also, of course, GGTMC, everybody involved with that, the ever-increasing crew, their blog, their podcast, their increasing media empire. Thank you guys for keeping me amused while I get exercise in the mornings. Of course, to Vince, Nick, Mary, and the rest of them over at the B-Moviecast. Love your work as well. Grant over at Bad Film Diaries. Thank you, Kirsten and Mondi over at The Writer and the Critic. And, of course, the women from the wonderful science fiction podcast, science fiction literary podcast, Galactic Suburbia. So, basically, yeah, listen to podcasts, offer encouragement to people who are keeping you entertained. And it's a noble thing that we do here, whether people do it well or not. The only way they're going to improve is with encouragement. So keep the faith, enjoy your movie watching as well, and just remember, in this podcast, like all the others, the importance is the audience. I had a zombie moment there. The audience is an important part of what we do, and really, thank you for your support. Bye.